You're listening to episode 1 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Yes, that's right. This is the GNU World Order. We talk about Linux and Unix and all kinds of geeky topics on this show. My name's Klaatu. I'm your friendly host. In today's episode, we shall talk about some listener feedback with a lot of very cool bashrc functions that you can check out. We'll talk about fdupes, a handy little command line tool that you may not know about yet. And we'll round it all out with a discussion of feedback and free software. So let's get started. Starting out with listener feedback, I got quite a bit of really cool listener feedback this time because I did, of course, ask what kind of bash functions were in your bashrc files. And I got a couple of responses back from that question, and they're all really interesting. I mean, that's just kind of the, you can't go wrong with a question like that. You know, people are going to send you something that's interesting, and you're going to learn something somewhere along the line. So I'm very excited about this, and I will post all of the functions that people sent me in some show notes. And remind me a little bit later to talk about show notes. But anyway, here's one. It's not really a function, I guess. It's an alias from Deep Geek. So he's created two aliases in .bashrc file for monitoring a server that he manages. Alias space C2Finger. So C2Finger is what he calls the alias. C2 refers to the name of his server, and he aliases this to quote SSH space deepgeek at nameofserver.net space single quote finger single quote close quote. So now when he types in C2Finger, he gets the output of finger for his server, as if though it was, you know, as if though he were logged into the server. So he can check it pretty much anytime he wants, and it quickly logs into his server, gets the readings of finger, and comes back and tells him all the information. And he also does a little bit of a status check, I guess. If he does an alias space c2stat equals, so again, C2 is the, you know, referring to the name of the server, and then stat equals double quote SSH space deepgeek at nameofserver.net space single quote PS, we all know PS, space dash capital C space THTTPD space dash O space space PID comma E time comma start comma VSZ comma percent mem single quote double quote, which quickly runs a ps command on his server, and then looks up the process for the web server that he's using, and he gives the process number, the time it's been up for in d-hh:mm:ss, where d is the days up, the start date, the memory usage in kilobytes, and the memory usage as a percentage of total memory. Sounds really cool. I like these kind of remote commands that you do through SSH. I don't actually do those ever, I think, which is kind of weird. So I think I'm going to start kind of looking into that, seeing what I can do sort of quickly and remotely like that. Really, the only remote task I do via SSH, I mean, without, I use SSH as, you know, just a secure shell to log in, and then I log in and I kind of sit in that shell and I do things. But it's kind of cool to just shoot out a command to your server and get back the results, and you don't really have to, I mean, you are logging in, but do you know what I mean? You're not really logging in. You're not opening a shell and sitting there and doing all the commands. You're just issuing the command and getting the feedback that you need. So that's kind of nice. I like that. Next, I got an email from, let's see who this is from, Remy. He says that he thought the PV CP tip that I gave last episode was great. He likes it, and he points out that rather than using Papa Victor to convey PV, I could have said pipe viewer, which is a very good point. But he also gave a really cool kind of quick I was going to say unzip, but that would be kind of wrong, so we'll call it an extract function, because that's what he calls it. So here's his function. This is nice. This is neat. So function space extract ; and then curly brace, just the, you know, a normal function. And so then if bracket space dash f space $1 close space close bracket semicolon then case $1 in star dot tar dot bz2 close paren, and then you can tab over and do a tar xvjf space $1 semicolon semicolon, or and then you do the next line and it's asterisk dot tar dot gz close paren tar xvzf space $1 semicolon semicolon, and so on and so on, and then like asterisk dot rar r-a-r close paren unrar space x space $1 colon colon or semicolon semicolon, and then so on and so on, and then you do asterisk dot zip close paren unzip space $1 semicolon semicolon asterisk dot z close paren uncompress space $1 semicolon semicolon asterisk dot 7z paren space or tab 7z space x space $1 semicolon semicolon, and then finally you end all of the possible combinations of, you know, all the different suffixes of compressed files with just asterisk paren, and then he echoes quote single quote $1 close single quote cannot be extracted via extract close quote semicolon semicolon, and then close your case with ESAC ESAC, and then else echo $1 is not a valid file, and then close your if statement with FI, and then close your function. So you kind of see what he's doing there, I'm sure, and that is that he has just defined a conditional statement, I think. Again, I like to throw out terms that make me sound like a programmer, so I'm going to call it a conditional statement. I have no idea if that's officially what it's called. So he's saying, you know, if the argument of my command extract and then the whatever $1 would be, so that's the first thing after the word extract, if that exists, then in the case that it is a .tar.bz2, run this command, tar xvjf $1. In the case that it is a .tar.gz, then run this command, tar xvzf $1. And if it's a star dot bz2, then do bunzip $1. If it's an asterisk dot rar, then do unrar x $1. If it's a zip file, do unzip $1. If it's a dot capital Z, do uncompress. Now he's leaving out, I notice, the xz command, which I'm kind of partial to lately, just simply because that's what Slackware uses for its compression these days. But anyway, you get the point. It's a big list of possible compressed files that it would be easy to add to, and that way you don't really have to think about how to unzip something or unrar something or un7zip something, because there's always, I mean, heck, I used to have enough trouble with the tar command, and so needing to remember how to do something that I don't even deal with that often, like actual zip files or 7-zip files or a rar file, this would make that very seamless. You wouldn't have to think about that. You would simply say, okay, extract that file because it's got an extension. I don't know the syntax of that archive tool off the top of my head. I think this is a brilliant function. I really like it. It's one of those functions that I could almost see myself writing, and I think I would have been embarrassed by it. You know, I'd have thought, oh, this is such a cheap function. This is just, it's a quick and easy way to to extract stuff, and I really should be learning these archive tool commands myself. Why am I doing this? And I'd use it guiltily. But luckily I didn't. Remy did. And now I can feel like it's okay because it's someone else's function. I don't know. I really like it. I mean, this is what Bash and Unix is all about, right? Being able to write little cheats for yourself like this function extract that completely changes the way that you use your computer. And sometimes they're really small ways. But that's the stuff that counts sometimes, right? I mean, like, when you are in the heat of the moment and you're programming or you're doing some art or something, and the last thing you want to do is flip over to a terminal so that you can do man unrar so that you can see what the heck you're supposed to do to unrar a file, or man unzip because you can't remember whether it's zip-xf or if it's zip-something and it turns out it's just unzip. You know, I mean, it's really nice that this just alleviates that. You don't have to think about this anymore. If you see an extension of an archive file that you're not familiar with, you can now just type in extract something and it happens. So I really like this one. This just feels like one of those really simple but really pragmatic functions. And I will post that code somewhere so that you can find it. Let's see, who else wrote me about functions? Well, Ron wrote me about a function in his Bash RC, and this is just kind of highlighting how he uses CD, and I don't know if this is proper. When I first saw this, I thought, can you do that? And I guess you can. So in Bash RC, he redefines CD pretty much. He says function CD, paren paren, curly bracket, and this is an interesting trick. It says built-in space CD. So the term built-in, and it's one word or it's one string, just B-U-I-L-T-I-N space CD. The term built-in, I'd never seen it before. So I went over, of course, to another terminal window and kind of did some investigation. Man built-in doesn't exist. Which built-in? I think that just returned nothing. But finally I opened up the man page for Bash itself, and built-in is sprinkled all through there. So, I mean, I'm gathering from context of this function that built-in is referring to, is saying, take the built-in version of CD rather than, you know, some other version of CD. So, to me, I think when I do this, I believe I'm just doing I think it's a backward slash. I don't know if you've ever used that. Like, if you have an alias, or if you're overriding a command, a built-in command, for instance, like, I did this for Trashy on a couple of people's systems. The Trashy is the little command line trash can that I wrote to prevent people from using RM to their detriment. So I literally aliased, not on my machines, but on some people, on some noob machines that I'm helping people with, I alias RM to run Trashy, so that when they say RM foo doesn't get literally blown away into the netherworlds. It is simply moved to their system trash. So that becomes a problem if you're removing a bunch of stuff or files with really, really weird names that I haven't learned how to really properly and reliably escape yet, things like that. So what I'll do in those cases, if they really want to remove that file, is simply use a backslash rm, or backslash anything really, and that says don't run the alias of this version, use the actual command. So that may be the same thing as saying built-in space command. I don't know for sure. That's what I'm gathering from reading, and it's something I'm going to have to research a little bit more. And you can certainly research yourself as well. Like I say, the Bash man page has the built-in term all over it, and it's a pretty big man page. But it's a great one. It's just astonishing sometimes how much literature is included in a typical Unix or Linux distribution. Anyway, back to this function. Function cd, paren paren, curly bracket, built in, space cd, space, double quote, dollar sign, curly bracket, at, colon, dash, dollar sign, home, curly bracket, double quote, space, and, space, ls, space, dash, capital F, space, dash, capital G, space, dash, capital H, space, dash, hol, space, dash, dash, color. Close the function. So this is an interesting one, not only for that built-in function that we've just learned about, but also because what it's doing here, if you notice, is it's saying run cd, and if there's nothing, then take me home. And that's being expressed with the dollar sign, curly bracket, at sign, colon, minus dollar sign home, close curly bracket. This I have seen used in Slack build shell scripts. They'll have certain things where they kind of allow almost for, okay, if there's no entry, then default to this. And that's what this is doing here. So that was really cool to see in a practical kind of place. And then, of course, it's doing the double ampersand to continue on and provide a list with a couple of nice flags on there of the directory that he just cd'd to. So the ls, the dash capital F shows you the difference between, say, a directory and a file, with things like trailing slashes or an asterisk, I think it is, for binary files, little touches like that. I've used that in the past from time to time. I think I've actually used it a lot. So the capital G in this command, and actually, as far as I know, the dash O in the command, are both excluding groups from the long listing. So there's actually a little bit of a double up action there. But the dash H, of course, makes it human readable. The dash L makes it a long list. And the dash capital H, I'm not really sure what that does. I looked it up. I just didn't understand what it did. And then the dash dash color, of course, gives color in a terminal that provides or enables, you know, is color, has colors. So yeah, it's a cool little redefinition of CD, I think. And I'll include that in the show notes as well. Oh yeah, and I forgot Pizza Dude emailed, actually. I don't know who Pizza Dude is. I feel like I should just know. Like, everyone should have, hey, there's the Pizza Dude. But who doesn't love pizza? So, yeah, he says that he likes GNU World Order, and he noticed that the site was down, and that now it's back up, and that he likes the new web design. So thank you, Pizza Dude. That was actually September 1st that he wrote that, so I'm about 2 weeks late in responding. Although I responded to him personally, of course. So Remy also sent another function called lstree. This is going to blow your mind. This one is amazing. The directory tree gives you, well, I mean, what it sounds like, a directory tree in your terminal. So if you do function lstree, he calls it lstree, paren paren, curly bracket. This is a long one, so I'm just going to I'll give you an idea of what it says. I can't possibly read this crazy sed line that's about halfway through this function, but I'll try to give you an idea. So it says, if dollar sign one, so if the first argument of the statement after the command does not equal nothing, then cd into dollar sign one. So that's basically saying if a parameter exists, use it as the base folder. So it says cd into dollar sign one, and it does an ls space dash r, which is recursive, space grep quote colon dollar sign close quote, and then you pipe that through sed. And the sed command is pretty pretty amazing, said space dash E space single quote S forward slash colon dollar sign forward slash single quote space dash E space single quote S slash bracket caret dash bracket caret backslash forward slash bracket asterisk backslash forward slash dash dash forward slash G close quote. So you see what he's doing there. Space dash E space single quote S forward slash space 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 space, it's four spaces, slash, single quote, space, dash, E, space, single quote, S, forward slash, pipe, forward slash, single quote. So I think you're getting an idea. Obviously, in the first said, he's removing the colons. In the second said, he's replacing the higher level folder names with dashes. In the third said, he's indenting three spaces, three spaces. And then in the fourth said, he's replacing the first dash with a vertical bar. Simple enough. And then it just gets better. And then he does an if loop of a bracket and says, if the results of LS space dash capital F space dash 1 pipe grep quote slash close quote pipe WC dash L close the result loop equals 0. So if there are no folders, then echo, there are no subdirectories. And then you finish the if loop. And then you echo something, and then you close the function. It's pretty much amazing. I don't know where this came from. I don't know if this is like his that he invented or if it's just something he found online. I was just thoroughly impressed with it. And I can even see myself using it. It just seems like I was saying how in his other one, the extract command kind of made it seem like you're changing little things in your environment to make a big difference. This just seems like you're reinventing your environment. You know, this is a completely different shell. If someone ran LS tree in their shell, I think I would be blown away. I'd be like, you're not even using the Linux that I know. What is this thing? And yes, it is Linux. It's just a bash function. That to me is really, really cool. So I'm going to post that code somewhere as well. And by somewhere, I mean the same place as all the others, which of course is in the show notes. So I think that's all of the bash RC functions that I got back since the previous show. They're all really cool. I learned a lot, and hopefully you have as well. And if you look at the code, I'm sure you'll learn even more. So have a fun time with all those commands. They're really, really enlightening and really, really fun. So I wanted to make a couple of quick, simple notes on the new website, simply because it has been mentioned a little bit by listeners. Gotten a few like bug reports, I guess you could call them. One was some confusion about the RSS feed. I'm not really sure what that ever resolved to. I think it might have just been sort of temporal weirdness. But the RSS feeds have not changed. GNUWorldOrder.info/og.xml or /spx.xml or even /rss.xml. RSS is the same as og in terms of content. So all those are completely the same, and I maintain backward compatibility or legacy report, whatever support, whatever you want to call it, for an old address that some people might still be using in theory. Nothing's changed about the feed whatsoever. I did have an issue where the speaks link on the main page was linking to the og file as well. So that's in the HTML, not the RSS feed. That has been fixed, and thanks to Snack Machine B and a couple of other people who reported that issue to me, that was much appreciated. Nolan, from the internets, emailed me and said that he found GPotter was dating the newest episode that I'd, or, you know, the 8x00 episode as 01/01/1970. So that's kind of weird. I don't really know why it did that. I don't know if it was just him. I test my feeds on probably fringe podcasting clients anyway, which I'm not really sure if that's the most useful way to test, but that's what I do just because it's kind of what I have. It's convenient. So it's working normally for me in all the different catchers that I'm using, which are KMail, or I guess it's called Aggregator, Thunderbird, and MashPotter. So I'm not really sure where that erroneous date stamp, timestamp came from. The way that I'm generating the XML and the HTML, for that matter, is a shell script called podwrite.sh, which I developed during that month that I was not doing episodes, and it's really, really basic and not terribly attractive, but it does the trick. So the way that I do it is I create one file. I call it, I think, episode.parse or parse.file or something like that. And this file contains, I believe, the episode number, a description of the episode, like the show notes, and any important links that I want to be associated, to have associated with the episode. I run this shell script, and it takes the current index.html and inserts the structure of a new episode, grabbing the episode number and the description and the links that it needs from that parsable file. So from that parsable file, it's generating the index.html page for the website, and then an aug and a speaks.xml file for the RSS feeds. And then I upload them to the server, and my job is done. That's compared to what I used to do, which would be opening up the index.html file, adding all the information in Emacs, saving it, closing it, opening up aug.xml, adding new episode there, pulling in all the same information, like the description and things like that, from the index.html that I just created, and then also generating things like the MD5 sums, or now I guess the SHA-256 sums, the size, the episode size, like the how many bits it is, you know, how many like bytes rather, how many bytes it is. So that was all kind of something that I had to do. And then I would open up the speaks.xml file and basically recreate everything from the aug except with the extension SPX. I started to do that with sed, but I mean honestly it's just you still have to copy and paste, and it's a lot of work. It was a lot of manual work for something that definitely could be scripted, and now it is scripted. It's not scripted on the server, it's just something that I run locally and then upload. Which works for me. I love that. It works perfectly. That's exactly what I needed. So, if you see any weirdness in either my XML feeds or the HTML page, just send me an email, let me know, I'll look into it. It's all pretty basic, so I have a feeling that it's, you know, there's just not that much room for error, I don't think, but who knows? If there's anything weird, just let me know. It's just something wrong with my script, I'm sure. And if you happen to look at the script and have cool improvements upon the script, then feel free to send me a diff file and I can improve the little script. It's really, like I say, it's just, I mean, it's embarrassingly simple. It's just a bunch of echo statements with a few variables that I've defined, and then a little bit of parsing of this parse file. And it's, you know, really, really simple. I use sed to insert it into the index.html file. I keep thinking that's not the best way to do it, but that's the only way I know to do it. So, whatever. It works. So, that's how the page and the feeds are being generated. And thanks for the feedback so far about them. Now, show notes. You'll notice that all the show notes are pretty much gone from the current website. So, quite a few people have been asking me, hey, could I get those show notes back? So, yes, you can. I am working on porting, as it were, the old show notes into sort of the new format of the website, because I want it to all look consistent. I'm also working, at least in theory, on reviewing all the old episodes and doing really proper show notes for all the episodes. Because I kind of realized funny enough, through my own attempt at using my own show for my own information, that my old show notes were really, really bad. I mean, like, patently bad. Why didn't you guys tell me, dear listeners? Were you just being polite? I mean, those were awful show notes. You couldn't find anything. Some people were asking me, hey, what was that episode that you did on TalkBook? I'd be like, oh, let me go look. And I'd look at the episode descriptions. It was horrible. And you couldn't search because all the seasons were on separate pages, you know, so you'd have to search once per season. It was terrible. And then if you're lucky enough to find something like, okay, if I'm looking for DocBook, look for DocBook. Oh, there's DocBook. Oh, no, that's not the episode. Although I can't tell from the show notes because it just says Klaatu talks about DocBook. It should have said Klaatu talks about how to, you know, the basics of getting started with DocBook versus Klaatu talks about how to make an EPUB from DocBook. You know, very specific kinds of, like, this is what you are going to learn in this segment. And it doesn't do that. So I'm going to go back and listen to some old shows. It'll take a while, but I'm just going to redo the show notes. I'm not happy with the quality of the show notes so far. I'm going to attempt to make them better in this season, and hopefully I'll manage to do that. Quite possibly I won't, and I'll have to go back and redo this season as well. But I'm going to try to make it better now. Anyway, if you are looking for show notes, for instance, the one that I have reinvented right now, if you go to the archive link on the main site and then go into Season 7, you'll see that there are OGG files there for Season 7, and there's one lonely little HTML file, and it's assigned the episode number .html, and there's all the show notes for the Lux command, the thumb drive encryption, and Git, how to use Git, how to set up a Git server, little things like that. So there's all the show notes. And so that's how I'm doing it right now, and eventually I'll probably come up with some kind of master index of how to find each of those commands, or each of those episodes, you know, by some kind of master list of all the show notes. I don't, you know, I really do hesitate to make this over complex. I don't, or over important. I don't want the show to seem like, oh, I've got so much important information here, I need to catalog it and stuff like that. But at the same time, if it's going to be on the internet, you might as well be able to access it easily and find what you're looking for, because otherwise it's just downright frustrating. And that's already happened to me, because I've been like, I know I did an episode on such and such, now where is it? And it's taken me way too long to find it. So, working on it, getting better, and hopefully that'll be something that happens over the course of the season. If there's anything in particular that you notice missing or that you need to know about, just shoot me an email. I will fix it. Wanted to mention another handy tool. This is not a bash function. This, I mean, it almost feels like it is a shell script. When I first heard about it, I thought, I'll bet this is some super simple shell script. So I installed the thing because a friend of mine, Zach, showed it to me, and I thought it was pretty cool. So I installed it via SBOPKG, and turns out that it's kind of a handy tool in a lot of ways. It's one of those, like, again, it just seems so simple. So here it is. It's called fdupes, as in find dupes, I imagine. Now, this is something that I usually use I usually don't do this for myself. It's one of those things that I actually don't usually have a problem with. However, some people do. Quite a few people that I know do. So I'm often doing diffs on other people's folders. And quite honestly, that usually works. That usually shows me the same, you know, where the folders are the same and what's different about a file or whatever. So that usually solves any kind of problem that I have, either myself or on other people's files. Sometimes it doesn't, because they're not really sure. Even though it looks like it's the same file, could it possibly be a different file somehow, and they still have to go manually check it anyway. But at least that points them in the right direction. fdupes is kind of nice because it wraps a whole lot of functionality that you could get from diff. You know, you could do diff and then figure out what do appear to be the same, and then you could sort of get MD5 sums of those two files to verify, yes, they exactly are the same, or no, there is something different in there, you better go manually check. And then you could even say, extend that further and say, okay, if you find a duplicate and if the MD5 sum matches, then delete the second occurrence of that file or whatever. And that's basically what fdupe does. So if you install fdupes, you can do fdupes and then point it to any directory, and it will scan that directory for duplicate files. So if you just do a test, I just copied like the GPL from user share doc, or user doc, whatever it really is, and put it into my home folder, and then copied it again and renamed it into the same directory and did fdupes. And sure enough, it showed me both of those files. It said, hey, these are the same thing. And it'll give you an option of what exactly you want to do with those, with the fact that you have duplicates. Now, there actually, it doesn't unless you pass the dash D, actually, because the dash D means delete. So if you do fdupes dash D and then a folder, it will find the duplicate files and then offer to delete specific files that are duplicated. You can also do it, of course, recursively, so fdupes-r recurses through the directory, -s follows all the symlinks, -H follows the hard links, and there are a couple of other things like making the deletions just automatic, don't compare empty files, stuff like that. It's really a handy little tool. It's not, I don't, even after installing it and kind of using it a few times, it didn't strike me as a game-changer, world-changing kind of command, but you can tell when it's gonna get really, really handy. You know, you're like, yes, I know the situation where I will need that. I mean, heck, I can think of about 20 people with completely unorganized music folders that I could have probably made, I don't know, at least a free lunch off of if I'd known about fdupes back in my days of using a different operating system. But I didn't, but from now on, I'm going to keep this in mind, because the next time someone says, oh, I've got all this music, and I'm pretty sure I accidentally copied all of it back into its own directory. I mean, you know the music application I'm talking about. There's a music application out there. It's very, I wouldn't say popular, because that has an emotional association to it. It's very ubiquitous. It seems to be out there because of the devices it is sort of sold along with, and it's a mess. You know, it screws people's music up beyond organization, and people get angry, and there's no built-in functionality to solve that. Or maybe there is now, I don't know. There wasn't back when I was around that operating system. Point being, this is a handy tool. It's a nice one to know about. It's called fdupes, like find dupes, duplicates, fdupes. It's out there. Look in your repository. It'll be there. It's even on SBOPKG, so it's there. Just install it, and, I don't know, tell someone that you're magic and that you can solve all of their duplicate file problems and get a cup of free coffee. Oh, speaking of coffee. Yes, it's true. It is time to go get another cup of coffee. So go make yourself one, put some nice fixings into it. We're out of black. It's okay. There's no wrong way to do this. And come back, and we'll finish up the show. A guy named Bert, which I think he's emailed me before on this very show, emailed me recently because I guess, well, I know, I asked about, like, how do you like your coffee? Well, Bert was asking me for Slackware logos, or was telling me that someone was asking for Slackware logos, which, by the way, if you ever need them, I posted, they were in my Slacker Media Git repository. This is all a tangent, by the way, sorry. But yes, they are in my Slacker Media folder, or Git repository in Gitorious, so you could find them there. But you can also find them on the GNU World Order site now. I just went ahead and transferred them over there as well. They're SVGs. I wouldn't call them official, I guess. I mean, I kind of would, because they sort of are. But anyway, go to gnuworldorder.info/images, and you should see a Slacker Media, or I think it's called Slacky logo or something like that. So it's the Slacker Media logo as well as the Slackware logo. Now, it's not it's not, when I say it's not official, it's, I didn't grab it off of Patrick Voltreading's hard drive. You know, I just recreated it in Inkscape. I don't really see how that's any different than grabbing it off of Patrick Voltreading's computer. You know, it's just like, it's courier font with a line underneath part of the words in a box. So that exists there. And then, as well, the cover underscore slackermedia.svg is my Slacker Media cover art, which has the circle, the blue circle with an S on it, and the underline. So that's the kind of the Slackware badge. So you could find that there. And again, that's a recreation. It's not from the official distributor of Slackware art or anything like that. The only source of this artwork I know of is a page called Propaganda on Slackware.com, full of bitmaps. So they're not very scalable. These SVGs are obviously very scalable, and they're a dead ringer for the authentic article. So if you need them, they're there. GNUworldorder.info/images, slacky underscore logo.svg, and cover underscore slackermedia.svg. Enjoy, and you will need the courier font, I believe it is, courier 10 pitch, to be precise, installed for those to come out right, or you can find a courier-like font in the multimedia sprint, of course. But courier is indeed the font that is being used there. Okay, so anyway, Bert's email had nothing, I mean, it did have something to do with that, but that's not why I mentioned it. I was actually mentioning it because of the coffee tie-in. So we just had a coffee break. Bert said, for coffee, he likes to extract 2 shots of espresso and add 6 ounces of hot water. Americano, they call it. It's funny, Bert, because that's actually one of my favorite ways of having coffee. Americano, probably, like, if I had a full coffee bar all the time, everywhere I went, you know, if I could choose at any moment what I would have, it would probably be an Americano. I got into the habit of drinking Americano. Well, I first had it over in France, and then I got into the habit of having it at an old job it was a computer store, and right across the street was a bookstore that also had a little cafe in it, and I'd go up to that cafe and have an Americano. And I don't remember why I did that. Maybe I wanted the fresh coffee and not the whatever they had sitting out. I don't really remember. But yeah, I really like Americano. And when I had an espresso machine back when I had an apartment, I would frequently make myself Americano. Because it's kind of the best of both worlds, right? You get the quality of an espresso, but not the, you know, but you get to savor it over a, you know, you get to sip it. You don't just throw back a shot of espresso and move on. You know, it's an experience, and it's really good. You know, the hot water really kind of makes it a lot more mild, obviously, because now the espresso is watered down, and it has a distinct flavor to it. And I remember when I first had it, it was kind of surprising to me, because I was really just looking for a cup of coffee in France, you know, and they were like, we don't have what you want, but we can give you an Americano, except they said it in French. And so I had an Americano expecting a cup of coffee like we have here in America. So when I tasted it at first, I was like really confused. I was like, what is this thing that they've given me? But it caught on really, really fast. I saw the virtues of it right away. So that's Americano coffee from Bert. I agree with you, Bert. I'm right there with you. Americano is a good thing. And that's not what we're going to talk about in this segment. What we're really going to talk about is this notion that Thrice in IRC actually kind of inspired when he was telling me about some people getting angry about the new Nautilus changes. So, you know how I like KDE, right? I like KDE. Well, KDE, I know well. You know, it's one of those things that I spend a lot of time in, and its nuances are things that I am very familiar with. I know exactly what program can and cannot have its menu bar turned off. I know exactly where the options are, the configuration options for each application, when they're not where they should, where they seem like they should be. I know all that stuff. And I guess some people are like that on GNOME. Now me, I flirt with GNOME. It's a fun thing to use in the evenings when I'm not really doing any serious multitasking work, you know? It's just kind of, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, I'm just saying, I don't use it like I use KDE. So the fact that Nautilus is undergoing changes, first of all, took me like 45 minutes to truly see the difference. Like, I looked at it, I was confused. I was like, what's different about this than what I've been using on Fedora 17 for the past 2 months, or 3 months, whatever. I honestly, off the top of my head, couldn't even tell you what the differences were. I think it was something about the top sort of button bar. There were some arrows, or there weren't arrows, or something like that. So it's changed, apparently. And some people get very upset about that, and they get up in arms. And Thrice in IRC was kind of agreeing with me. I think he was agreeing with me, but he was kind of saying that he didn't understand. Maybe I was agreeing with him. He didn't understand that in people, how they kind of speak very negatively about an open source project, and they think, I think it was Thrice who was saying this, and they think it's like their way of contributing, you know? It's like, I'm going to be very loud and noisy on the interwebs, and I'm going to talk very badly about this free program that I downloaded for no cost and am using, and as my way of paying the developer back and contributing to this project, I'm going to complain loudly about how much it's gone horribly wrong. And I thought about this for a little while, trying to really, truly understand it. And I thought right away, really, that negativity is technically a contribution, right? I mean, staying silent on something is definitely a zero-sum contribution. We can probably all agree on that. There's nothing there. Negativity is technically a contribution because you are expressing an opinion, you're expressing thoughts, you're giving feedback, and you can't say that that's not contributing. Whether it's the best possible way to contribute, maybe not, whether you could contribute what could be defined as a negative feedback in a positive manner, again, kind of another question. You know, you could say, hey, really great revisions to Nautilus. I really like what you did. How about also adding an option to add this feature, which used to be in the old Nautilus anyway, that you took out and that I liked? You know, it's kind of like one of those things. So that's sort of that side of the argument, and I think that's kind of common sense, and it's good, and it's there, and it exists. But thinking further about it, I even thought, well, actually, okay, before thinking further, I've had this conversation with The Last Known God as well before, and he said, if you don't have anything nice to say, then maybe you shouldn't be saying anything at all. And to a large degree, I also agree with that, because I think that at least, especially when you're not even, when you don't have a vested interest in something, then your feedback is basically useless, and it would be a better thing for everyone if you didn't give feedback, you know? So for me to say, well, Nautilus is horrible now because I don't like the look of it, and I don't like the rationale behind the developers doing this change, well, I mean, I didn't even notice the change, so who cares what I think, you know? So, and for the record, I'm not saying that it's a horrible change. I'm just saying, as an example, if I said that, it would be pointless, because I'm not truly speaking from experience. I'm not speaking because I care. I'm just speaking because there is a conversation, and I felt like speaking up. And we all do that sometimes, unfortunately, and sometimes we look back at it and we say, why did I even speak up? I'm not even a part of this argument. I should have just sat back and read a book. Okay, so, but thinking further on the issue, though, taking it really, really far out. Or not so far out, but farther out into a different idea, I think. I kind of realized, because I find myself getting caught in this trap myself. And I believe that some people, possibly you yourself at times, dear listener, so listen up, this could be important. I think that some of us free software users, we get very excited about the idea of taking over the world. And who wouldn't, right? I mean, come on, everyone wants to take over the world and establish their way of doing something as the correct way. And of anyone, we have the most right to do that because we are right, right? So we get very caught up in sort of this feeling of it being a movement. And we want it to be something that other people can use and do use, and we want to be able to go to our friends, and we want to say, look at this, isn't this cool? Isn't it perfect? Don't you just want to switch to it right now? And I think that comes from a good place, because it is, you know, we just want to make everyone do things our way, because our way is the right way. And that's fine. But we kind of have to understand sometimes, I think, that that's not necessarily the intent of the developers. And it isn't necessarily the right way to design software, or to kind of let that be your guiding force when designing software and writing software. What upsets us as users sometimes upsets us because we perceive it as violating and betraying our personal goal of switching everyone to our operating system. So, for instance, I keep harping on the idea that the global menu bar is the answer. And I don't know that that's absolutely correct anymore, actually. I've kind of gotten used to having menus on all my applications. And when I'm on a dual screen setup on other operating systems with global menu bars, I actually do kind of, I've finally started to see how it's kind of tedious to keep grabbing your mouse and going up to that one stupid location just because you don't remember where something is in the, you know, you can't do something with a keyboard shortcut. You have to look through the menus. Isn't it more convenient what that menu is right there? I'm not saying that I wouldn't rather have that menu bar in a nice little chromium-style wrench icon up in the corner so that it's out of my way, but point being, there are certain things that, you know, yes, we as users, and we as users with a very specific audience in our radar, in our sights, in our scopes, whatever, we have certain requirements. And when a developer, we feel like they've betrayed us because they've done something that we didn't expect or something that we don't particularly care for. And so we start getting very upset about it. You know, we start banging on the tables. How dare you do this? This isn't right. You should never do this. I mean, it's the same mentality as when people are saying, and I know I've said this before myself, where, especially when you're new to Linux and to free software, you're like, why doesn't everyone just stop working on separate projects? Why don't we all focus our attention on one really good video editor or one really good Photoshop killer or whatever? And you think, yes, let's do that, you know? And that's just not how it works. I mean, yes, I know that we as users have this movement that we want to support, and we want to move in, and we want to take things over, and we want to convert everyone, and we want everything to be just perfect and spit and polished and everything, but that's just not how it works. Developers don't do it for that reason, and they shouldn't do it for that reason. And the goal isn't really to take over the world at the end of the day. The goal, probably as with any movement, is to really just make yourself more free, whether it's because you're using more free tools and you're getting better at them, and you're being more productive and more efficient on these tools, or whether it's to use up fewer resources on the planet and be sure that you recycle very frequently, or whether it's to be a peaceful person and to not support going to war and things like, you know, all of these different movements that people get involved in, they are frequently projected outward, but I mean, at the end of the day, aren't they really internal struggles and internal kinds of things? I know I'm getting like deep into philosophy here, but isn't that the case? That's really why we're doing things for ourselves, and then we turn them outward and try to share these great discoveries with other people, which is of course the very basis of free software, right? We know that we have the propensity of doing that, the tendency to take something really, really exciting and cool that's changed our life and to share it with friends, which is what we do with software, and so we should be able to do it, so free software enables us to do that. But that doesn't mean that developers should or or will design software just so it can help take over the world. Because if you stop and think about that, you will realize that that's an impossible goal. The goal to take over the world is totally possible, and we're working on that. But the goal to sneak into people's homes and swap out their operating system and have them wake up and realize and not even notice, that's not possible. People will never accept that. It's not going to happen. You can make GIMP a dead ringer for Photoshop. I mean, it could just be, everything could be there, and people are still going to find some problem. Maybe not with GIMP. Maybe they'll find a problem with the way that the mouse moves. Maybe, you know, I mean, it's just not, it isn't possible. The way to make their operating system free and free is to make their operating system free. And that's not going to happen to their operating system. And until that person wants to change to a free operating system, it's not going to happen. You can't trick them. The developer can't emulate everything exactly like you want them to emulate. And why should they? And so it's just not going to happen. So why bother? The GNOME developers, I think especially right now, just kind of because they're in the spotlight, for better or for worse, I don't know how they feel about it, but they're doing incredible things. They're coming up with great ideas, with some great little conventions that are unique to GNOME. It's a strong platform. It's really, really cool. And I wouldn't want to be the voice of negativity to say, you guys should slow down, you guys should take a step back, you guys should reinvent the wheel, you should go back to GNOME 2. No way. I think they're doing a fantastic job. I love all the changes that they're doing. Thrice, actually, in IRC told me about a GNOME release, like a live ISO release. I grabbed that, copied it to a thumb drive, booted up a spare computer off of the thumb drive, ran it for a little while, and it was gorgeous. It was beautiful. It was so nice. It's just little touches here and there, you know, go back out to your different screen of applications. There's a button for that now. And Nautilus apparently changed. Just little touches here and there that I really just thought was incredible. They even changed that stupid menu where you, in order to log out, you go to log out and there's not a log out. It's just like suspend. So you have to hit Alt to go to log out. I'd gotten used to that by now, but they changed it now. So if you go to log out, it's actually a log out. And if you hit Alt, I think it's either a suspend or a power off. So I guess they crumbled a little bit there. I forgive them. They're doing a great job. Don't lose sight of the fact that the free software community needs to be a community of autonomous, independent people. And if you start yelling at them and telling them that they must never change your favorite feature, then you're kind of doing it wrong, you know? And I don't mean that harshly. I just, because I do the same thing, right? I mean, I get angry. I get frustrated when something changes. Well, no, I don't. I'm just pretending. But if I did, then I would. And I would be sensitive to the developers. And maybe even more importantly, I'd be sensitive to the fact that we don't want to emulate the other stuff. The progress comes because of free software. Progress comes through, sure, borrowing ideas, but also coming up with new paradigms, coming up with new concepts, new ideas. That's how it works. That's how it happens. And that's why we like it in reality. One thing I'll append to all of this, too, is that it cannot be said that Linux developers, free software developers, force you to change. Yes, they make it difficult not to change, just sort of the way software works. You upgrade your system, you get the latest things. If they have changed, then you've changed. But it is still free software, and if you want to run an alternative desktop, or you want it to run the old version of some particular software, you're free to do that. And see here, I'm being very careful not to say, why are you complaining? Just go get the source code and compile it yourself. Because that sounds rude. But actually, that's kind of right. I mean, that's instead of being negative and complaining about something that someone has changed, keep in mind why you're using this stuff. It's because it's free, you respect the freedom, and so you've got the freedom yourself to go back to GNOME 2, or whatever you want to go back to, GNOME 3.2, grab the code for Nautilus, and whatever that entails, compile it yourself, and there you go, you've got exactly what you want. And it sounds flippant to say that, I think, and it can be said flippantly, you know, as a sort of dismissive, hey, pipe down, I don't like your negativity, go compile the old version yourself. Really, that's right. I mean, that's the answer. Like, and that is why you're using free software. And if you don't take advantage of that, if you don't take the advantage of going out and getting the source code and maintaining something yourself because that's what you really want, then you're almost not even using that sort of freedom, you know, civil freedom kind of aspect of free software. You're using software that didn't cost you any money, and that's really all you're getting out of it. You're not actually utilizing your power to compile, you know, which isn't a bad thing, but if you're going to complain about something, it kind of is a bad thing, because you do have the ability to go out and get exactly what you want separate from what the mainline distribution of that software is offering you. It's all a touchy subject, and I'm trying to be sensitive to the fact that we all do want to take over the world. We all do want our software to be exactly how we want it to be, and all of that, and that not everyone knows how to just go out to GNOME 3.2 and grab the old version of Nautilus and compile it. Heck, I wouldn't know how to do it and still get it to run with 3.6. I don't even know if it's possible. I don't know if it's abstracted that far away from the rest of the desktop. I know that GNOME 2 used to be really weird about having Metacity and Nautilus running at the same time. You couldn't have one without the other or something. So I don't know the extent of it. You know, you might have to reinvent GNOME 2, or GNOME 3.2, or whatever you're after, just to get that functionality. But my point still is that it is there. It isn't the same thing as a computer company making something obsolete and forcing you to upgrade. And it sometimes seems to me like people are more complacent about when big companies do make things obsolete and force them to change than they are when free software does it. And it's not even the same group of people, I'm sure, so it probably doesn't really equate that much. I'm guessing people who suffer at the hands of big companies making big changes that forces them to upgrade all kinds of devices, they probably just know that they'll never be heard if they do waste. So why waste energy on being negative or giving feedback at all when they know that there's no chance of them ever getting what they want? Whereas in free software, you actually do have that chance. People might actually listen to you. People might change stuff. A community might form and you know, recreate something that you did love, like the Trinity Desktop, TrinityDesktopProject.org or whatever, where they're literally continuing to maintain KDE 3 branch. It's pretty bizarre, but it's there, and that's how this stuff works, and it's cool. So I think I've talked myself into a circle a little bit, because I started out saying, hey, don't be negative, and now I'm saying, hey, if you're negative enough, you might find a community of other negative people who then rebuild exactly what you want. And I don't know that those are exactly the same things, because you can rebuild a community without being totally negative, so I guess that's not exactly the same thing. But my point is that taking free software and demanding that it conform to your every desire and whim is not necessarily the obligation of the developers. It's free software, the developers are making it, and you're using it for free, and the power to change it is technically in your hands. And I keep telling this to people around me too, because, and they're not listening, but I keep telling them, with free software, you can take that code. You could pay a developer to go in and make the changes that you want if you absolutely don't have the ability to do that yourself. It is possible. It's an option that is out there for you. So, I don't know how I feel about people just being blatantly negative out there in blogs and on the internet. It's just not something that I think is all that constructive. Intelligent feedback is one thing. Outrage is a little bit different. So keep that in mind, won't you? That's about it for this episode, I think. This has been GNU World Order. My name's Klaatu. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info. You can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can IRC me on IRC, on Freenode Network, in the channel Ogcast Planet and a few others. You might also find me on Jabber sometimes. I don't get on there very often lately, but I'm not klaatu@jabber.org. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Ah, why can't that be done?